Lecture 23, Evolution, Aggression, and Cooperation.
We are back and in the home stretch here, ready now to look at our most long-term influences on the biology of aggression. Following the strategy of this whole course, we have looked at the neurobiology of the environmental influences on working all the way back. And where we finished in the last lecture was looking at genetic influences on aggression. Genetic influences rather than genetic causes. And insofar as there are any genes relevant, they are not going to be genes all about aggression. There are going to be genes about pain and fear and stress and frustration and impulsivity and sensory processing and all of those caveats that we've had hammered in by now. And where we left was with our inevitable next subject. If you're talking about genes, you've got to talk about how those genes evolved. What about the evolution of aggression and violence? What about natural selection? What about the ecosystems, the ecological factors that have sculpted over the course of evolution our genetic makeups and those pieces that are relevant to aggression? What does evolution and what does ecology tell us about where aggression comes from in us? Turns out ecology is very informative, and one of the useful things we've done as humans is go and inhabit every single corner of this planet virtually and thus come up with very different societies as a function of what sort of ecosystems we find ourselves in, what sort of livings we make. And out in the less developed world, the non-westernized world, you get broad categories. People tend to be agriculturalists or hunter-gatherers or nomadic pastoralists, people who wander the desert, the open grasslands with their goats, their camels, their cows, and you tend to see very different social structures relevant to aggression. One of the more reliable findings out there is nomadic pastoralists have more violent societies than do agriculturalists. And in fact, taking the form, nomadic pastoralists seemingly invented the concept of having standing armies, having warrior classes. And the logic of that is quite straightforward. It is very hard for somebody to come and steal your 5 acres of corn overnight. It is quite easy for somebody to raid and steal all your cattle overnight. Moreover, there are times of years when the grass not only is greener over there, but 14 plateaus over, where half the men in a village will be elsewhere grazing the animals, and you need to have some sort of system of reciprocity and stable sort of military cooperation to protect the animals there. Pastoralist societies have much higher rates of organized violence than do agriculturalists. Another thing in there that winds up being fairly consistent is derived from this desert societies versus rainforest societies. And desert societies are basically the ones in which nomadic pastoralism was invented, and you see far higher levels of aggression in desert cultures than in rainforest ones. Far higher levels of aggression, far higher levels of things like taking of slaves, of trading of women as brides, far higher rates of very stratified hierarchical systems of command within the society. And very interestingly, and not of trivial significance, it is the world of deserts that have invented monotheistic views of the world. People living in rainforests, dealing with 1,000 different edible plants, seem to have far less trouble coming up with a multitude of deities relevant to their lives. The desert world has given rise to some of the most rigid and singular and monotheistic views of the world, and violence and aggression and organized violence in hierarchically organized systems are more likely in those cultures. Okay, so that tells us something about how ecology may influence the sort of societies we come up with. What does now framing that in the concept of evolution, we know by now what that means, how these factors just discussed change the distribution of genes over time, and we can go off and running with that from there. What do changes in gene distributions mean? We know that on a molecular level. We know by now how that may turn into differences in brain function. What does evolution tell us about aggression? And initially, it tells us nothing but bad news. Back to our building blocks of evolutionary thinking from way back when, a zillion lectures ago, we've got individual selection, a chicken is an egg's way of making another egg. We've got kin selection, I'll lay down my life for two brothers or eight cousins. And those two, the first three building blocks, are real and formative in explaining some of the most appalling and common features of violence on this planet. Whether you are looking at virtually any primate species out there, including humans in culture after culture, one of the most common forms of violence is male-male aggression over reproductive access to females. And all you need to do is look at human literature, and that runs through all over the place. And if non-human primates had soap operas and could write novels and things of that sort, it would be one of the major themes there. And geez, what's that about? That is inclusive fitness 101, that is passing on as many copies of your genes, that is one of the driving forces on aggression in this planet. Once again, back to that dichotomy we had between tournament species and pair bonding species. You don't see high levels of male-male aggression in the pair bonding monogamous species, but the polygamous ones are specializing in that. And as we saw in the section on those imprinted genes, we as humans are most certainly genetically not a monogamous species, so we've got plenty of violence built around that. Now, that basic building block of evolution also tells us a lot about that utterly puzzling pathological form of violence we've seen a number of times, infanticide. Competitive infanticide, again, it makes no sense if you're behaving for the good of the species, and even in a species on the brink of extinction, it makes sense on that level of individual selection. So none of that's good news. Shifting to the level of kin selection, none of this is good news either. Is essentially what the notion of is you cooperate with relatives, and the more related they are to you, the more cooperate. What have we just defined on evolutionary terms? This is what xenophobia is about. This is what us versus them is about, and this is a whole world of organized violence amongst non-human primates. This is about animals obsessed with kinship, and it's not merely to figure out who to invite to the bar mitzvah sort of thing. This is a whole world of who is the them and who is the us. And we see among those chimpanzees, talked about a few lectures back, organized violence, patrols along their territory, killing males from elsewhere. Who are these male chimps? They are close relatives. They are brothers. Males do not leave their home troop. They spend their whole life together. And one of the most dangerous things you can ever get on this planet are a whole bunch of males who've grown up together and get along well and who are worrying about the folks in the next valley. Because that sets you up for this patrilocal world of organized cooperative violence. Okay, so now we think about these issues as they apply to humans. And there's something different about us. How does a rodent figure out who its relative is? We heard the pheromonal stuff. It just knows. It can tell by smell who its relatives are. This is the case in all sorts of species. How do we humans figure out who we are related to? We have to think about it. And that's where we get problems. Because as soon as it is something we can think about, it is something where our thinking can be manipulated. And that leads us into a world where rather than non-human primates thinking about kinship, what we think about and can be manipulated about is the sociological concept of pseudo-kinship, being made to feel more related to somebody than you actually are genetically. And this is a theme that runs through all sorts of human societies over and over. After revolutions, people adopt terms of pseudo-kinship, calling each other brother, sister, comrade. After the French Revolution, it was against the law to use the French pronoun that you use for people outside the family. Everybody had to be addressed in the informal form. We are all siblings now. And one of the things that militaries, ranging from the most high-tech one to the nomadic pastoral warrior tribes do, one of the things they are brilliantly skilled at is making people in the military feel more connected to each other than they actually are, producing pseudo-kinshiped bands of brothers. And all the rituals about it are to build up that sense of when it's the critical moment, the person standing next to you, for whom you may have to sacrifice your life, feels as good as a relative. In some societies, what you see is people, when they go into the military, go in as cohesive units from their high school, people who've known each other their entire lives, in other societies, various pastoralist societies. What you see in the militaries, the warrior classes there, are ornate rituals that hold for the rest of the lifetime of pseudo-kinship terms for each other, where a woman who will marry one of these men will refer to the men in his warrior class age group as their equivalent terms of brother-in-laws. All of this built around trying to make people feel more related to each other, pseudo-kinship, and this is run through every military out there. And of course, lurking in the background is the flip side of pseudo-kinship, which is pseudo-speciation. Hand in hand with all these manipulative means to make your us's feel more similar than they actually are is a brilliant legacy of manipulation to make them seem so different they hardly count as human. And this has occurred over and over, beginning with the huge percentage of cultures on this planet whose word for people is the word for their own tribe. The them hardly even counts as the same species. Throughout American wars, this has happened again and again, even down to the level of medical journals giving articles proving how the them are different medically from normal humans. You see cases of this endlessly. You see an astonishing case of this that occurred about some years ago in the early 1990s, one that we as a country here in the United States fell for at approximately a 92% rate. In the fall of 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait, and in the aftermath of that, producing what is now historically known as the Gulf War. And during October of that year, a refugee Kuwaiti nurse who had escaped from Kuwait City came and testified before the Congress of the United States. And what she testified about was an incident that had occurred in her hospital. Iraqi troops had come in, and as part of the plundering, shipping things back to Iraq, they plundered a critical thing in that hospital. They took more than 300 babies out of incubators and stole the incubators and shipped them back to Iraq. And we were left with this astonishing notion: these people leave premature infants out to die. They care so little about life that they will let babies die in order to steal incubators. And our collective breaths were taken away, and this was covered in every newspaper. And at the time of the vote authorizing the Gulf War, a vote that passed by 5 votes, 7 of the senators cited this incident in their decision as to how to vote. And it wasn't until a few months later that it became clear that this refugee Kuwaiti nurse was not a refugee Kuwaiti nurse. She was the 15-year-old daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. A publicity PR firm in Washington had been hired with the cooperation of the U.S. government to concoct that story. This child was trained to come before our Congress, lie to us, and we fell for it with a 92% approval rate for that war. And the stories saying that this event never occurred were buried in the back pages of every newspaper. And there's no rodent on earth who would have fallen for that. They would have smelled a rat in a second. And this capacity we have to have our best of emotions and empathies manipulated and to wind up saying, these people hardly even count as human, they leave babies out to die, had a galvanizing effect on our decisions of what counts as moral or immoral behavior. And thus what you have, the second you have humans with their capacity to have their cognitions about who is an us and who is a them to be manipulated dramatically and consistently, the us versus them has very little to do with what board games we like to play, but instead always has something to do with what we look like and what we speak like and what we eat and who we pray to. And that is a defining feature of how readily we are manipulated into thinking who is an us and who is a them. So seemingly what everything about evolutionary biology is teaching us here is bad news. The selective advantages of the well-placed killing, how this drive towards kin selection could be manipulated to produce some wildly damaging organized cases of violence, but embedded in that is the first of our bits of good news in this last lecture. And the whole point here is, if you could be manipulated into thinking that they are so much the them that they hardly count as human, pseudo-speciation, the same could be done in the opposite direction. And what we see in our society over and over is whenever we reach a détente, whenever we reach some sort of peace with some culture that we previously had tensions with, we are flooded with articles about how basically they just want to be like us. They're really just like the folks next door, and look at them, and all they want to do is have the same fast food and the same blue jeans, and they're really just like us after all. And this is a theme that has run through all sorts of examples like this. Among traditional Bedouin societies, for example, if there is a point where two different clans that have been at war work out a treaty, a peace treaty with each other, there is a ritual where the elders from each clan are brought out, sit down, and spend a whole afternoon kibitzing with each other, and what they always wind up doing is discovering a relative that they have in common. Aha, we're not really enemies, we're related after all. This utterly artificial mechanism by which you decide this isn't a bunch of thems after all, they're another version of us's. And the same rituals that give rise to being able to view somebody else as so different they hardly even count can be used in the opposite direction. And this is a theme that runs through a whole lot of cultures, ways of making peace seem more palatable because the thems are actually more like you than, oh, we appreciate it all along. And we saw a limbic example of that a few lectures ago, that extremely disquieting finding that the amygdala, which lights up with fear, with aggression, all of that, the finding I've come back to a few times now simply because of its importance, finding that the amygdala will activate when you look at the face of someone from a different race of you. Oh my God, a hardwired version of us and them. And what we then saw subsequently were far more interesting studies showing that that won't be the case if you were set up to view that other face as an individual rather than as part of a category. There's nothing inevitable about that. That is your amygdala showing you right then and there in a gazillion-dollar scanner that pseudo-kinship can work in that direction. So what else winds up being good news? Another piece of good news has run through the primatology literature in recent years. And this is a whole different version of individual selection, passing on as many copies of my genes as possible. And what's that about within the realm of males? Males punching it out with each other for reproductive access to females. And what has become clear is that's not the only thing that male primates do. And the trendy term that is now used is male alternative strategies. And the increasingly recognized sort of ubiquity of this is really striking, and it is built around the incredibly radical notion that some males would rather hang out and be friends with females than do all this jerky male-male competition stuff. Isn't that nice? The Alan Alders of the baboon worlds, and isn't that wonderful? And we know, nonetheless, nice guys finished last. And what the studies are also now showing, paternity studies of the genetics of reproduction, is these nice guys are not finishing last in terms of passing on copies of their genes. Females have far more control over who they mate with in a lot of these big hierarchical primate societies than the 1960s textbooks would have you think. And what is the shocking, just staggering finding that has come out of that literature? Who do females like to mate with? Guys who were nice to them. Guys who were nice to them, guys who, when they're in a bad mood, go beat up somebody else instead of you. That is a prince you bring home to mom. That sort of thing. This radical discovery that females, in fact, are deciding to a large extent who they mate with, and it's males who have the affiliative relationships with females. There are evolutionary alternatives to males just punching out. Even in the classical tournament species, there are other ways of doing things. So that's very good news. Now, the next piece of good news is our third piece of sort of the introduction to modern evolutionary biology. Number one, passing on copies of your own genes, individual selection. Number two, kin selection. Number three, this concept that has run through a number of our lectures by now, reciprocal altruism. And by definition, this has to be good news. This is the world of the evolution of non-relatives cooperating with each other. what we saw many lectures ago was sort of the building block of this world of studying the game theory of reciprocal altruism, the prisoner's dilemma. We remember those circumstances. We remember the very surprising and pleasing bit of news. When do you release dopamine in those pleasure pathways in people playing the prisoner's dilemma game? When you have screwed your opponent and gotten away with the most points, no, you see activation there under circumstances where both sides are cooperating. What was not mentioned back when, of potentially great relevance to that study, this was a study only carried out on women. And one would be very interested to see if you see the same thing in males as to what counts as the most dopaminergically pleasing outcome of the prisoner's dilemma game. But what we saw there was, under the right circumstances, this is exactly what you want to be doing. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, reciprocity. And we also saw the whole world by which it makes sense to cheat when you can and to be vigilant against cheaters. And we saw this huge theoretical problem of who jumpstarts the system. How do you get reciprocity to start in a world where nobody's cooperating? And what we saw were some of the key variables that give rise, that make cooperation more likely. Dealing with an inbred population, dealing with circumstances where you have multiple rounds of interactions with an individual, so treat them badly and they're going to have umpteen chances to get back at you, the shadow of the future. Dealing in circumstances where you have what was termed open book play, you sit down to play against somebody and they know what you've done in previous games, reputation. We see also the ability to punish cheaters, and even to punish people who fail to punish cheaters. Secondary punishment selects for cooperation very dramatically. And finally, the ability to choose who you're playing against. All of these are circumstances that greatly increase the likelihood of some sort of cooperation emerging. And amid this being a whole world of wonderful theoretical biology, and as we saw, biologists of all the unlikely things hanging out with mathematicians and economists and computer programmers to make sense of any of this stuff, what also emerged from that literature is a sense of, well, do you ever actually see this going on? And we heard a couple of examples from the world of non-human animals where it looked as if there were some systems of stable reciprocity, maybe even ones that fit the optimal game theory strategy that we saw there, the tit for tat. You cooperate until if the person defects against you, you defect the next time back. You do whatever the person did in the previous round. Aha, this was the strategy that outcompeted all the others. We saw there were some elaborations on it, but mainly at the end of that stretch, we saw there are some animal examples of that out there. The stickleback fish, believing it is attacking an invader, bashing its lips against the mirror there, and now believing it has a partner doing the same, the mirror alongside of it, and then the mirror angled so that it believes it's being defected against by its partner, and it reciprocates by defection the next time. Vampire bats that appear to do the same thing. Stable coalitions of non-human primate males. If one guy stabs you in the back at a point where you thought he was a reliable coalitional partner, that increases the odds of you cooperating next time around. Yes, there's all sorts of examples of this floating around in the animal world and a very, very active area of research. So what about humans? What about humans, and what about humans being able to evolve systems of reciprocal altruism in the most unlikely of circumstances? And the last bit of good news we will hear is some very dramatic examples of this. The initial one is not too exciting because it has a structure to it that simply does not make for generalizability to other settings. Nonetheless, it is worth hearing about because it's just so dramatic. And this was during the first winter of World War I. As Christmas approached and the vast majority of the combatants there having some strong emotional attachment to Christmas and some ritualistic belief that this is not a good time to be slaughtering perfect strangers from across the trenches, it was decided in the upper echelons that there would be a Christmas truce. It's really not good news and good luck to be having wild battles going on Christmas Day. So there was going to be a truce. This was a top-down decision. The individuals in charge decided there would be a Christmas truce, and it was meant to be just for the afternoon. How that was decided, how you let the folks on the other side know, we're not going to try to invade your trenches when we're all singing around the Christmas tree there. Please don't do it in return. Nonetheless, they managed to have this sorted out, and it was known beforehand there is going to be a truce at Christmas. And what was extraordinary is what was originally supposed to be, okay, we're not going to shell you, you don't shell us, we're going to lay low for that afternoon, before it was over with, as documented in photographs, front page newspaper articles, troops from opposite sides of the battle were out there above the trenches sharing Christmas dinners, having soccer matches where it was not even the French against the Germans, but intermixed by teams, exchanging Christmas gifts with each other, sharing food, having concerts. This soldier in the trenches, who was an operatic singer beforehand, leading the singing. And what is extraordinary is they almost stopped the war with that one, because they refused to go back to fighting until the officers had to come and threaten them to get them to go back to their war. And the people you were having dinner with and singing songs about the blessed, peaceful earth, you were trying to kill the next day. That's tremendously moving. But nonetheless, the thing about that is not easily generalized was it was a top-down approach. The people in charge decided to institute it. They nearly lost control over it at the end and had to force the war to continue, but it was a top-down approach. The next example is the one that is most moving of all, because it's a bottom-up example. And this also took place in the trenches of World War I. And this is one that was documented by Robert Axelrod. We remember his name from many lectures ago, the economist who first did the prisoner's dilemma games with other social scientists and emerged from that the tit-for-tat strategy in a book of his called The Evolution of Cooperation, documenting this one case that happened in the trenches during World War I. And the thing about this one is nobody planned it. No one negotiated it. No one let people know this is what's going to happen this afternoon in 2 days. There was a bottom-up spontaneity to it. There was a bottom-up emergent property. The men in the trenches almost stopped the war. They worked out a system of reciprocal altruism with people who didn't speak the same language as you, people whose faces you may never have even seen. There was a system of reciprocity that emerged over and over in the trenches. How do you do this? Here's what would be done. You get your best gunner up there who lobs some shell 20 yards behind the enemy's line and blows up some tree there. What do you do next? You have the guy do it again and again and again. What are you telling the other side? This guy is so good, we could have put 20 shells down in your trenches just now, but we chose not to. What are you going to do about it? And then they get their best gunner and lob 20 shells behind your lines, and you've just shown reciprocally that you are willing to use restraint. And this happened again and again along the lines. Axelrod documents letters from soldiers there writing back home, "Dear Mom and Dad, I'm okay, we've worked out something here." They even worked out a way to deal with the vulnerability of tit for tat, which was if there was a signal error, which is you get some new gung-ho gunner who doesn't understand how things work and takes out the trench on the other side, they get one shot back at you. And documented again in letters, "Dear Mom and Dad, things are fine right now. We had a problem the other day. We had this new gunner who didn't really understand how things work here. We hear they lost a bunch of guys on their side, but everything is fine now." And over this emerged without negotiations, without treaties, without anything other than people very intent on saving their lives. And over the trench truces were broken up by officers, transferring troops up and down the lines laterally, trying to break this up. And over it happened again. And what is encouraging here is there were no negotiations going on after months of arguing about the shape of the table. There were no diplomats sitting there eating their nice meals while discussing under what circumstances fighting would cease. It was simply people in a bottom-up way pulling this off, using spontaneously the same principles that make sense here, and they almost stopped the war. And essentially what we have as a punchline there is, if it could happen under those inauspicious circumstances why by all logic the other is just nearby and your amygdala is screaming its head off and you are so frightened and your sympathetic nervous system is going so wild you can barely stand it, there are still mechanisms by which it could almost have been stopped. And if it could have succeeded to that extent there, it could work anywhere else. We have no excuse for saying it's an unstoppable circumstance. So this brings us to the end of the lectures on aggression. And if the last umpteen lectures had instead been focused on integrating all these pieces and understanding schizophrenia or understanding parental behavior or some such thing, it would have been interesting as well. This is an enormously important subject, though. For the same reason that started off at the beginning of this major challenge, there is no debate over the fact that schizophrenia is a disaster. There is no debate over the fact that childhood cancer is the worst thing imaginable, Alzheimer's disease. These are unquestionable biological ills and unquestionable biological disasters. But aggression is different. And again, it's the same set of behaviors and some of those same neurons sending those same commands to those muscles. And in some cases, it is the most exciting thing in the world and we can barely stop ourselves from jumping in. And in some cases, it is our worst nightmares. It is a rape. It is poison gas coming out of a shower head. It is a mushroom cloud. It is the things we fear most and have the most reasons to. And the challenge of the biology of this is how similar those states can be. And it's for that reason the biology of understanding violence is always going to be the most challenging subject in this whole field, and it's for that reason it will always be the most important one for us to try to understand.